John Steve Brown, Assistant Professor of Educational Leadership at UW-Oshkosh. Now, here's today's Education Matters moderator.
Good morning. Welcome to Education Matters. My name is Mike Kehoe. I'm one of the rotating hosts for this program. We're going to be talking today about a program called ALICE. And before we do that, I wonder if my three guests would mind just introducing yourselves and stating your names so that the audience at home can connect the voice with the individual, and tell us a little bit about what you do.
John Wenberg. I'm a Kenosha police officer, have been with Kenosha Police Department for 19 years. Most of my 19 years I've worked in the school district. The first seven were at Bullen Middle School as an off-duty security there. The last 9 years I've worked as a full-time school resource officer at Tremper High School.
And my name is Leanne Pepper. I am a special education teacher at Bullen Middle School, and this is my first year teaching.
I'm Pat Finnemore. I'm the facilities director for Kenosha Unified. Been with the district for about 16 years, and one of the people involved in doing the ALICE training at our schools.
Okay, and again, I'm Mike Keough. I'm the host for this program. I'm also a special ed support volunteer at Bullen Middle School, and was 12 years with the district in various capacities, primarily as a substitute teacher. I was very surprised and pleased last week when our assistant principal asked me to be involved in the ALICE demonstration and training at Bullen Middle School. I really wasn't aware that we were doing that much in the district. The last I remember about it was when they had an event for upper-level administration, primarily over at the old Edward Baines building, and that was a couple of years ago, and I was very pleased to be involved in it, and I thought you all did an excellent job presenting it. Perhaps, though, our audience isn't aware of of what ALICE is, and John, maybe you're the person to explain that.
Well, ALICE, it basically is a response to an active threat in a building. It's not necessarily geared just to schools, but you know, obviously for KUSD's purposes, that's the approach we're taking, and it's just a response that gives us a little bit more options to deal with an active threat, opposed to our traditional lockdown method that we were practicing.
I could add maybe a little bit. You know, and John is actually one of the people who introduced ALICE to KUSD. We have a safety security committee, which the two of us are members of, and I think it was about 3 years ago, maybe now,
yeah.
3 years ago, we chose to have a conversation, a meeting about active threat. And I had put that on the agenda for the sole purpose of I was not satisfied with lockdown as being our only response. And John and Dan Wyrock, who are two of our SROs, brought up this ALICE training that they had attended and said it was really good. And so that was kind of the initiative that started a few years back and has led to now training all of our staff this year.
I know that those of us who are in classrooms are certainly appreciative of having additional options and some training to go through. Leanne, we've talked about this a couple times this week. You were the procedure made quite an impression on you. So maybe why don't you explain to the audience what we did?
Well, so that was my second experience in the school system with a drill of that kind. So the first time that we did a drill was the traditional lockdown. And so going from that and having that experience with the kids to going into the ALICE training, it was a completely different approach. And I found it, you're right, it absolutely did have a really big impact on me. And I think that knowing that we have options as far as, you know, authorizing the employees to do what they think is necessary in an emergency situation like that is really important, and I like that part of the ALICE training as opposed to, you know, the directive being that we are going to basically roll up and hide.
I don't know if you know, Mike, but, you know, lockdowns, at least this was the training that we were given, the idea of a lockdown at schools initiated in Los Angeles Public School District or Unified School District, and it was in response to drive-by gang-bang shootings. And the whole idea was if there was a drive-by shooting concern, they would turn off the lights in classrooms, everybody would duck down low, and that was its initiation to schools. And then it slowly kind of developed into being the response for any sort of active threat. And, you know, the more that I observe things, the less it made sense. And I think for a lot of people after the Sandy Hook massacre, which their response was to go to lockdown, I think there was kind of nationwide a lot of people started to question the you know, how rational that philosophy was.
The I kind of followed the events that have been occurring since these incidents got transferred from college campuses where they originally occurred most frequently. That's where we originally heard about it, to then Columbine, and then all the numerous incidents that happened after that. And one of the things that they did at Columbine was that they locked everybody down and kept them in the school for a long period of time, and in the school was where the danger was. I can't remember ever reading about an incident where intruders in a school were there to injure or kill or make mischief ever posted somebody outside the building.
There's a good example. I don't know if you remember that one. It was, John, it was Arkansas or Kentucky. But what they did, it was two individuals, two students. One of them went in the building, pulled the fire alarm, ran outside, and then he and his partner hung out at the woods and shot at people evacuating. That's the only one I can think of that was like that.
Yeah, and I don't recall exactly where that
it was. It was someplace down south. But otherwise, you're right, Mike. I mean, they are in the building. And you know, one of the things that we cover in the training, and I was doing training at Bradford last Friday when you guys were at Bullen, but one of the things I mentioned at Columbine is even though the strategy was to lock down, over 700 kids at Columbine High School evacuated that day. They ignored their training and they went by their gut instincts or their survival instincts and got out of the building but unfortunately that lesson really wasn't learned until many years later by schools. So.
And that's generally what's going to happen when the schools have a training manual, an emergency procedures manual. When something of this nature happens, it goes in the wastebasket, and people have to improvise, and the students are going to do what they're going to do. I've been in numerous lockdown drills, and the biggest problem is sometimes just keeping the kids quiet.
Yeah.
And one of the things we saw at the beginning of the program at Bullen was videotape of Columbine.
Yeah.
And several of those students that we saw come to a bad end might very well have survived if they just could have kept quiet, but they were so traumatized.
Right. Maybe just to back up, ALICE is an acronym. The A stands for alert. The L is lockdown. The I is inform. The C is counter, and E is evacuate. And the thing that I liked about it when John and Dan first started talking about it, I was looking at a program called Run, Hide, Fight. And that was a very similar program, and it was receiving a lot of publicity at the time. But it was a sequential kind of thing. You know, your first, if confronted by an active threat, you're to run if you can. If you can't, you hide. And then if you can't hide, you fight. And the thing that I liked about ALICE and, you know, what we try to stress in the training is it's not linear, it's not sequential, it's based on the information that I have available, I'm going to make the best decision for myself and whomever I'm responsible for. And it's not you do one thing and then you do the next and you do the next. So I think that kind of philosophy was attractive to us.
Yeah, I agree that response where you have only one option for each scenario doesn't fit, you know, the real life. Same thing with fire drills. At Tremper, we've even started doing fire drills, and then we will block off an exit and say, no, this is where the fire's at. Well, with fire drills, kids do their monthly fire drill, and they all go the same way every single time because that's what they're told to do. So it just gets you thinking a little bit, and we would block off an exit and say, well, that's where the fire is. You can't exit that way, and we'd make them find an alternate route. Alice is in kind of the same sense. It's empowering the teachers and at higher level, you know, high schools, maybe even the kids to making a decision on what's in their best interest. Ultimately, we want the teacher to kind of assume responsibility for that classroom at any level, but, you know, it empowers them to make that decision on what seems to be the best decision at that time.
And what I was going to say is I like the focus on critical thinking as opposed to following a policy, which is why, you know, the discussion of how it's not a linear response. You assess the situation, and then you make a decision based on the information that you have. And I think that's, like you said, I think it is empowering.
Yeah, one thing that occurred to me with regard to that is that from experience that I've had with people in emergency situations, you know, we all hear about people not reacting. People will react if they have been presented with some options. If there's some clues in their head as to what they should be doing, they will do it. Certainly in a school situation, I don't know of a teacher who doesn't really have a really strong motivation and inclination to protect the students. But if something that's completely unexpected happens to you and you have never really talked about anything other than locking the door and turning off the lights, you aren't going to be able to do the kinds of things that the teachers, I think, will do if these events occur after they've had this training.
And as a direct result of the training, I can tell you that since I'm special education, I follow my caseload, and so I go from classroom to classroom. And I can tell you that since the training, I know exactly what I would do in each and every classroom. That was the first thing that I did on Monday morning when I walked back in after the training was – and I don't even, it was just second nature. It wasn't even that I was consciously making the decision to do it. It was just, I was looking around and I was making sort of mental notes about what would be, you know, good escape routes, what would be, you know, possible use as a barricade, that sort of thing.
Right.
Yeah, this is a district-wide program, right? Eventually all the schools are going to have this.
We started training at the schools 4 Fridays ago. We're doing this every Friday from first Friday of February was the first schools we did. I think we did 3 elementary schools that afternoon. And we go through the second Friday of May. So it's essentially every Friday other than spring break, we're doing somewhere between 2 and 7 or 8 schools. And we have 5 training teams. Each team has 3 people. You know, we divvied up the school district accordingly, and each of the teams is doing about 8 or 10 schools, training 8 or 10 schools.
And the thing that strikes me as being so important, because it's what Leanne just referred to, is every school is a different tactical environment. Yeah. And what she's talking about doing is doing a tactical analysis of her her caseload and where she is every day and where the kids are and also which kids are likely to act which ways.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things we're trying to, you know, it's a 3-hour training and you can only do so much in 3 hours, but the hope is that that 3-hour training moves from this presentation and these active simulations to the folks in the schools having conversations and making some, you know, decisions as to what makes best sense for their school and their classroom. And so I think we're seeing a lot of that already. I've, you know, the first couple schools that we did, I've already gotten, you know, callbacks to their school because they've wanted to talk about, okay, here's what we've come up with now on how we would barricade our rooms. What do you think? You know, it's kind of interesting to see how creative some folks have become with their rooms. One of the neat ones last Friday was because we did my group did three sessions at Bradford, and in the first session, one of the science teachers, we were in mid-presentation, and he came up. He didn't want to raise his hand. He didn't want to interrupt, and he came up by me while one of the other presenters was talking and said, I have no idea what I would use in my classroom as a barricade. And I said, well, you're going to get a chance to test that out here, you know, a little bit later. And he was all kind of nervous about it, and his group in the second simulation where we allow them to barricade their room, they barricaded their room and the police officer couldn't get in. So, you know, that was my comment, you know, as the day went on, that with very little forewarning, a lot of people came up with some very, you know, very successful ways of barricading the doors of their rooms.
Yeah, maybe this would be a good point, Leon. Could you describe what your experience was? I mean, from start to finish, what your group did?
Well, so my group was your group, Michael.
Oh, we were in the same one.
That's right.
Okay.
And so there were three scenarios. The first one was we were asked to do exactly what we had been trained to do previously, which was to lock the door, I think. The fiction was that we had locked the door, but of course, you know, our fictitious gunman had gained entry, mm-hmm. And to essentially hide in the corner. The second scenario, we were allowed to barricade, and in the third scenario, we were asked to barricade and then determine whether or not it would be safe to evacuate. We had, I guess, our pretend fatalities were pretty minimum. We were very successful with the barricades both times, and other than the first scenario when the gunman was supposed to enter, there were no entries into our room.
And there's been a lot of conversation about it this week, and like you said, there were a lot of useful suggestions. One of the main areas people seem to be concerned about is getting notice to the people in the building,
yeah,
and then making sure that everybody has the ability to lock their room if they have to. And the narrowness of the halls and some other things like that, yeah, that are kind of unique to our building. But one of the observations I had is that all of us in those individual scenarios of the three groups, everybody has very subjective impressions about what happened. We were all in our own little world at the time, and we... one of the things that was credit to our group, I think, is that we all cooperated and worked together a lot. But there was some effort in that. And some of the people I've talked to said that was very difficult for them, and that they really were just kind of almost frozen, except for the action of the other people, which raises the question for me is, how are we going to act if we're the only adult in the room, or if maybe there's one other adult in the room? I think that I've been in one or two of these situations long, long ago, and my experience is that even if you've been through one, you don't know exactly how you're going to react the second time. But very often, if you're the only person there, you are perhaps more likely to take action than if there's a bunch of other people there and you start looking at each other trying to decide.
Yeah, I think one thing you brought up earlier, Mike, was that by doing this kind of training and then hopefully continuing to do training, that you start to take something that in a stressful situation where you may not know what to do, by practicing it, you get that confidence to do something. One of the things that's been kind of neat has been we did administrator training this summer. So we trained all of the administrators, a number of police officers, some office staff, and kind of a variety of folks this summer. When that training was done, it was hard to prevent our principals from going back to their schools in the fall and not wanting to do something because they had went through what you two had went through on, on Friday. And so a few of the principals had called me up and said, you know, I know we can't practice evacuating and we certainly can't practice countering and things, but is there any reason we can't barricade? I mean, it's barricade is part of lockdown. And my answer was, why not? You know, so we actually have had schools this fall with students as part of their lockdown drills doing barricade. And they've been elementary schools. So Stoker was one. Stoker Elementary, they started barricading this fall as part of their lockdown drills with the students. And so when the training took place at Stoker, which was it was one of the first schools that we did, and I wasn't one of the trainers there, but our police officer couldn't get into any of those rooms because they had been, as staff, been practicing with their students on how to barricade. So, you know, I think where this is headed is what I've told the groups I've been training is this spring we still have another lockdown drill at the schools with students. I'm recommending to any school that I've been training that when you do that lockdown drill, incorporate barricade as part of it. And then next fall, we're going to be training all of our students as well. And then that fall lockdown drill is no longer going to be a lockdown drill. It's going to be a fall ALICE drill. And, you know, hopefully that'll start the cycle of getting folks comfortable with the options that they have. And you know, there'll be people like John that'll probably give them some scenario like at Tremper and say, okay, here's where the threat is, and then people are going to react, whether they would lock down a barricade or evacuate.
One of the things that I think that the training makes us aware of is the fact that they're not just major incidents like Columbine that trigger the appropriateness of action such as this. I can think of two incidents that I've been involved in with as a teacher where a student brought a gun to school. These things are not the only, these major incidents are not the only things we need to be prepared for. John, maybe you have some information as to how often situations like this occur in the schools that the police have to respond to.
I would think that 9 out of 10 incidents that happen get no media or any recognition because a lot of them are solved or defused before it becomes an issue. We have had issues where there was a gun in the school, not an active threat or a person intending to use it, but it was brought there, and obviously the potential of that, you know, being used is there, but so each circumstance is kind of different, but quite often, you know, these are things that never get brought up or seen. So when we see all these, you know, Columbine and Virginia Tech and all these where it's all over national news, there's 90 more of them for each one of those that gets diffused before it happens and never becomes an issue, and everyone did, you know, involved, you know, did a great job and implemented whatever, you know, practice they have that helped solve that before it became an issue.
That's a great point. It raises something that came up at dinner that I was having with last evening with a couple of lawyers that I know, and they were saying, well, you know, this happens so rarely. How will you ever know whether this program is effective? And I think one reason you know is you can tell it how well does this school react even in a situation that turns out to be not a realistic event, not an actual event. And there is benefit in situations that are not as severe as is what we witnessed at some of these schools where people are killed. But even if the likelihood of an event occurring is very small, as NASA found out on two occasions with space shuttles, as long as there's some likelihood of it happening, it will happen. A mathematician will tell you that it will happen sometime, someplace.
Yeah, and that's kind of how we have to prepare for things, is not what if, but when. And that's the kind of mentality that we're taking with this. I guess from this, I'd like to see it even continue further after next school year begins and we start training the students as being part of this. I would like to even continue it further with maybe putting something together about early warning signs or things to look for in someone that would is displaying these behaviors or mannerisms or risks, if you will, of an active threat, to our school.
How good are the profiles that have been developed, or are there any profiles that have really been developed? I'm thinking of the incident that occurred in my old hometown, Marinette, that my cousin was involved in as a police officer. I read the FBI report on it, and they got glowing remarks at responses as to how the school had performed and how the police had performed and everything. But they were never able to get any handle whatsoever on this kid who did the shooting and why he did it.
Yeah, the why is always, I think, a question. I think the FBI did put together some statistics that can kind of indicate who is more likely, so to speak, and kind of call it a profile. They took I just jotted a couple notes before I came here, but in this study, they had 160 active shooter incidents. Only about 25% of them are in educational buildings. So about 40 of them, actually, I think it was 39. 158 of those incidents involved only one shooter, because that's always a question we were getting in our trainings is, well, what if there's someone else outside? Well, that's, you can what if those a lot. But from what we know, here's 158 out of 160 are individual people. And that kind of goes back to what I was mentioning earlier, some of these pre-warning signs or the incident being diffused before it becomes. A lot of times if there's more than one person involved in it, one of those people doesn't want to follow through with it, and they're the ones that end up coming to the authorities and telling them what's going on. So some of the other if you want to call them profiles, would be out of those 160 incidents, 154 of them were males. So that kind of points you in one direction. A lot of the middle school and high school shootings involved either former or current students. So there are things you can put together to look for, but I would, like I was saying, I'd also like to see, maybe educating all the staff in the district on, things to look for, writings and homework assignments, them jotting notes on their notebook, anything that, would stand out as not normal behavior or maybe things that would be like a red flag for this type of behavior.
And your comment suggests to me something that we do with our anti-bullying program, and that is to try and encourage students to be better citizens of the school, to care about each other, to make friends, and to try and have at least one teacher in the school that you feel close enough to, that you will go and talk to that teacher, that you'd be able to talk to that teacher and have confidence that...
Yeah, it's absolutely like that. We also have what's called a Quick 50 program in the school district, and what it is our Crime Stoppers donate some money to us to reward kids for providing information on someone or a student or someone else in the school with a weapon. And when I would give class presentations, I'd often talk about, these scenarios, and I'd bring up the Quick 50 program. And the bottom line is none of these kids, even the hardest, toughest kids that we have in our school district, don't want other kids in the building with a weapon. I mean, any of these shootings, It's not like a school shooting. Someone comes in, gets their one target that they're intending, and then they leave. There's a lot of casualties, and there's other people, innocent victims, that aren't even part of that plan that end up getting injured or killed. So I'd be given this presentation, and within, you know, the next few weeks, you'd be surprised at how many people would come to me and say, you know, if I did see something, I would tell you. And some of our, you know, rougher, harder kids did come to me when another kid did have a knife or some type of weapon they brought to school, and right away they're quick to tell. They don't want that in their school.
Yeah, I was just going to add, you know, the one of the two trainers that we brought in to train our administrators and our police officers was a guy named Ed Dorf, and he was the principal at Green Bay East High School. And, you know, kind of to the point both of you are making, Green Bay School District adopted Alice in response to an event that was averted at his high school. It was a situation where two kids had plotted and planned an attack on the school, and they alerted one of their friends the day before, said, "Don't come to school tomorrow." The kid they alerted was probably a lot more of a difficult student than the two that were plotting this thing, but he had a relationship with an assistant principal at the high school, you know, because he had spent a lot of time in his office and because he was in trouble. And he heard that from his friends, and he went ahead and made that contact with the assistant principal. They alerted the police. They went to these kids' homes, and they found a full arsenal of weapons. And that was that, you know, that type of situation where, because there was a connection between an adult in the building and a student, you know, potentially a, you know, major tragedy was averted. And then that was a wake-up call for that school district.
And it doesn't even have to be in the nature of fingering someone or pointing somebody out as a danger. Just expressing concern for another student might get them some help that they would need.
Correct. Right.
The aspect that was discussed somewhat in our training yesterday that I think the public may not be aware of but interested in would be the things that the school district is doing to improve security with the buildings and your interest.
Yeah, I'd be glad to mention it. So I went to Alice training about 20 months ago. I attended training that was done at the Kettle Moraine School District. And I left that training thinking, you know, that there's got to be some, I left that training with the same kind of energy that anybody else went through it. And so we've got to do this in our district. You know, and my first conversation was with the superintendent and saying, I really think we need to do this. But then secondly was, what can we do physically to support our teachers and our students? And so we looked at, you know, kind of a three-phased approach. One was, you know, the A part, the alert. How can we better alert people in the building that there is an active threat? And you know, the two of you could speak to it, but in the past, a lockdown could only be initiated by the office. You know, so they would get on the intercom and get and say, you know, Trumper High School or Bullen Middle School is in a lockdown, and then everybody would react. You know, one of the things that was stressed in the Alice training is that anybody should be able to do it. And so we had to put something in place. And so we did a kind of a two-pronged piece for the alert. The first was we installed telephones in every classroom, every office of every school. So that was an $800,000 investment that the school district made to do that, because we only had telephones in classrooms of the new schools, and we had a lot of not new schools. The second part was we put in a system called InformaCast. And so the thought behind it was that in a stressed situation, you see a person walking outside your classroom carrying a gun, you may be calm and be able to convey that. Somebody else may be completely panicked. And so we wanted something that was as automated as possible. And so that's what we've done. There's a simple couple key entry on the phones that any staff member can do, and it automatically plays a message over the intercom system and the phone system at that school. It also notifies our district emergency response team, and it tells us what school and what room number and what telephone extension initiated that alert. It also, for folks like us on the emergency response team, it automatically tells me what's the nearest camera or what are the nearest cameras to that room. And it pulls them up, and I can look and say, okay, I see where that is, and I see the threat. The third part of our effort was to really expand the camera system we have in the district. We had a lot of cameras at high schools, very few at middle schools, and most of our elementary schools had none. And so we now have a little over 1,500 cameras in our district. All of those cameras are integrated. We have a couple of locations at the Educational Support Center that have access to all the cameras at all of the schools. And so if there is an event at Bullen High School, we can remotely look at all of those cameras. We can also remotely get on the intercom system at any school in the district. And so that was part of the thought on Inform, was that I'm remote from the school. I'm not in the trauma at the time. My heart will probably be beating pretty hard as well, but nonetheless, I would not be in harm's way, and I could be looking at the cameras in our office and be over the intercom telling folks in the school where the threat is, what the threat looks like. It's a male wearing a gray hooded sweatshirt walking down the hallway outside the gymnasium. And then the final tie-in of that was that we've given access to our cameras to law enforcement. So the 911 call center has access to our cameras. The sheriff's department has the tactical unit, whatever it's called, John. And that there's access to all of our cameras at all of our schools on that tactical unit. So we've tried to bring as much information that would then be able to help the folks that are in the middle of that event make those kind of decisions. Do I evacuate? Do I lock down and barricade? And also provide as much information to law enforcement as to where the threat is.
Yeah, I was really impressed with that because for people like Leanne and I, you know, we have to respond during that first critical 5 minutes before the police get there. And until recently, the information that we would be given, the notice that something happened would be an announcement on the PA system. All staff, please check your emails.
Yeah.
And by the time that's happened, the police are already there.
Right.
To hear this pre-recorded voice would be something that would notify us and also impress on the kids that something serious is happening and give us an opportunity to do something. And then the training that we had gave us some options.
I was in the same training you guys were, and I was, you know, same scenario, same simulations. I was in a different school. I was in the Kettle Murray Middle School. And as I was sitting in those rooms, I'm thinking, okay, they're telling me I can evacuate or I can barricade, but how do I know? You know, I mean, there's this guy with a gun in the hallway someplace, and I have no idea where he's at. And so that was the thought process. And then we just started talking to people who were a whole lot smarter than us. How can we do this? And really, the system we have is truly state-of-the-art. There's nothing like it in our state, and I don't even know if there's much like it in the country, but there's a lot of people looking at it. We've had so many school districts come and look at what we're doing. The fact that I went through my training at Kettle Moraine, they came right back after we put our systems in, and they're installing the identical systems in their school district right now.